For women raised to fear, too often anger threatens annihilation. In the male construct of brute force, we were taught that our lives depended upon the goodwill of patriarchal power. The anger of our others was to be avoided at all costs because there was nothing to be learned from it but pain, a judgment that we had been bad girls, come up lacking, not done what we were supposed to do. And if we accept our powerlessness, then of course any anger can destroy us. But the strength of women lies in recognizing differences between us as creative and in standing to those distortions which we inherited without blame and which we are now, or in which are now ours to alter. The angers of women can transform differences through insight into power, for anger between peers births change, not destruction. And the discomfort and the sense of loss it causes often is not fatal, but a sign of growth. My response to racism is anger. That anger has eaten clefts into my living when it remained unspoken, useless to anyone. It has also served me in classrooms without light or learning, where the work and history of black women was less than a vapor. It has served me as fire in the ice zone of uncomprehending eyes of white women who see in my experience, the experience of my people, only new reasons for fear or guilt. And my anger is no excuse for not dealing with your blindness, no reason to withdraw from the results of your own actions. When women of color speak out of the anger that laces so many of our contacts with white women, we are often told that we are creating a mood of hopelessness, preventing white women from getting past their guilt, or standing in the way of trusting communication and action. All those quotes come directly from letters to me from members of this organization within the last 2 years. One woman wrote, "Because you are black and lesbian, you seem to speak with the moral authority of suffering. Yes, I am black and lesbian, but what you hear in my voice is fury. What you hear in my voice is fury, not suffering, anger, not moral authority. There is a difference." To turn aside from the anger of black women with excuses or the pretexts of intimidation is to a war of no one power. It is merely another way of preserving racial blindness, the power of unaddressed privilege, unbreached, intact. Guilt is only another form of objectification. Oppressed peoples are always being asked to stretch a little more, to bridge the gap between blindness and humanity. Black women are expected to use our anger only in the service of other people's salvation or learning. But that time is over. My anger has meant pain to me, but it has also meant survival, and before I give it up, I'm going to be sure that there is something at least as powerful to replace it on the road to clarity. What woman here is so enamored of her oppression that she cannot see her heel print upon another woman's face? What woman's terms of oppression have become precious and necessary to her as a ticket into the fold of the righteous, away from the cold winds of self-scrutiny? I'm a lesbian woman of color whose children eat regularly because I work in a university. If their full bellies make me fail to recognize my commonality with a woman of color whose children do not eat because she cannot find work, who has no children because her insides are rotted from home abortions or sterilization, if I fail to recognize the lesbian who chooses not to have children, the woman who remains closeted because her homophobic community is her only life support, the woman who chooses silence because of another death, the woman who is terrified lest my anger trigger the explosion of hers, if I fail to recognize them as other faces of myself, then I am contributing not only to each of their oppressions, but also to my own. And the anger which stands between us then must be used for clarity and mutual empowerment. Not for evasion by guilt or for the further separation. I am not free while any woman is unfree, even when her shackles are very different from my own, and I am not free as long as one person of color remains chained, nor is any one of you. Get it? Nor is any one of you. I speak here as a woman of color who is not bent upon destruction, but upon survival. No woman is responsible for altering the psyche of her oppressor, even when that psyche is embodied in another woman. I have suckled the wolf's lip of anger, and I've used it for illumination, laughter, protection, fire in places where there is no light, no food, no sisters, no quarter. We are not goddesses or matriarchs or edifices of divine forgiveness. We are not fiery fingers of judgment or instruments of flagellation. We are women forced back upon our own women's power. We have learned to use anger as we have learned to use the dead flesh of animals, bruised, battered, and changing. We have survived and grown, and in Angela Wilson's words, we are moving on. With or without uncolored women, we use whatever strength we have fought for, including anger, to help define and fashion a world where all our sisters can grow, where our children can love, and where the power of touching and meeting another woman's difference and wonder will eventually transcend the need for destruction. For it is not the anger of black women which is dripping down over this globe like a diseased liquid. It is not my anger that launches rockets, spends over $60,000 a second on missiles and other agents of war and death, slaughters children in cities, stockpiles nerve gas and chemical bombs, sodomizes our daughters and our earth. It is not the anger of black women which corrodes into blind, dehumanizing power, but bent upon the annihilation of us all unless we meet it with what we have, our power to examine and to redefine the terms upon which we will live and work, our power to envision and to reconstruct anger by painful anger, stone upon heavy stone, the future of pollinating difference in the earth to support our choices. We welcome all women who can meet us face to face, beyond objectification and beyond guilt. And that was a chapter on the uses of anger. Women Respond to It by Audre Lorde. I also want to start reading section on the poison of the injection of internalized racism between people of color, within people of color. Those of us who have been taught from a very young age that we were less than a white people, that we were somehow uglier and more stupid and less worthy as a human, as rather as an element of the earth, rather an expression of the life of the earth. It's interesting to note that those that are hell-bent on destruction, that are hell-bent on destroying the earth and making it into a wasteland of nothing, are white people, and they have told us that we are somehow less than them because we choose the nurturance and the replenishing and the healing of the earth. Excuse me. Who is really inferior here? Either I, black women, hatred and anger. Where does the pain go when it goes away? Every black woman in America lives her life somewhere along a wide curve of ancient and unexpressed angers. My black woman's anger is a molten pond at the core of me, my most fiercely guarded secret. I know how much of my life as a powerful feeling woman is laced through with this net of rage. It is an electric thread woven into every emotional tapestry in which I set the essentials of my life. A boiling hot spring likely to erupt at any point, leaping out of my consciousness like a fire on the landscape. How to train that anger with accuracy rather than deny it has been one of the major tasks of my life. Other black women are not the root cause nor the source of that pool of anger. I know this, no matter what the particular situation may be between me and another black woman at the moment. Then why does that anger unleash itself most tellingly against another black woman at the least excuse? Why do I judge her in a more critical light than any other, becoming enraged when she does not measure up? And if beyond the object of my attack should lie the face of my own self, unaccepted, then what could possibly quench a fire fueled by such a reciprocating passions? When I started to write about the intensity of the angers between black women, I found I had only begun to touch one tip of a three-pronged iceberg, the deepest understructure of which was hatred, that societal death wish directed against us from the moment we were born black and female in America. From that moment on, we had been steeped in hatred for our color, for our sex, for our effrontery in daring to presume we had any right to live. As children, we absorbed that hatred, passed it through ourselves, and for the most part, we still live our lives outside of the recognition of what that hatred really is and how it functions. Echoes of it return its cruelty and anger in our dealings with each other. For each of us bears the face that hatred seeks, and we have each learned to be at home with cruelty because we have survived so much of it within our lives. Before I can write about black women's rage, anger, I must write about the poisonous seepage of hatred that fuels that anger and of the cruelty that it spawned when they meet. I found this out by scrutinizing my own expectations of other black women, by following the threads of my own rage at black womanness back into the hatred and despisal that embroidered my life with fire long ago, before I knew where that hatred came from or why it was being heaped upon me. Children only know only themselves as reason for the happenings in their lives. So of course, as a child, I decided there must be something terribly wrong with me that inspired such contempt. The bus driver didn't look at other people like that. All the things my mother had warned me not to do and be that I had gone right ahead and done and been must be to blame. To search for power within myself means I must be willing to move through being afraid of whatever lies beyond. If I look at my most vulnerable places and acknowledge the pain I have felt, I can remove the sources of that pain from my enemy's arsenals. My history cannot be used to feather my enemy's arrows then, and that lessens their power over me. Nothing I accept about myself can be used against me to diminish me. I am who I am, doing what I came to do, acting upon you like a drug or a trizzle to remind you of your meanness as I discover you in myself. America's measurement of me has lain like a barrier across the realization of my own powers. It was a barrier which I had to examine and dismantle piece by painful piece in order to use my energies fully and creatively. It is easier to deal with the external manifestations of racism, sexism, than it is to deal with the results of those distortions internalized within our consciousness of ourselves and of one another. But what is the nature of that reluctance to connect with each other on but any but the most superficial levels? What is the source of that mistrust and distance maintained between black women? I don't like to talk about hate. I don't like to remember the cancellation and hatred. Heavy is my wish for death, seen in the eyes of so many white people from the time I could see. It was echoed in newspapers, in movies, in holy pictures, in comic books, in Amos and Andy radio programs. I had no tools to dissect it, no language to name it. The AA subway train in Harlem, I clutched my mother's sleeve, her arms full of shopping bags, Christmas heavy, the wet smell of winter clothes, the train's lurching, my mother spots an almost seat, pushes my little snow-suited body down. One side of me, a man is reading a newspaper. On the other side, a woman in a fur hat staring at me. Her mouth twitches as she stares, and then her gaze drops down, pulling mine with it. Her leather-gloved hand plucks at the line where my new blue snow pants and her sleek fur coat meet. She jerks her coat closer to her. I look. I do not see whatever terrible thing she is seeing on the seat between us, probably a roach. But she has communicated her horror to me. It must be something very bad from the way she's looking, so I pull my snow coat closer to me, away from it too. When I look up, the woman is still staring at me. Her nose holes and eyes huge. Suddenly I realize there is nothing crawling up the seat between us. It is me she does not want her coat to touch. The fur brushes past my face as she stands with a shudder. And holds on to a strap in a speeding train, born and bred a New York City child. I quickly slide over to make room for my mother to sit down. No word has been spoken. I'm afraid to say anything to my mother because I don't know what I've done. I look at the sides of my snow pants secretly. Is there something on them? Something's going on I do not understand, but I will never forget it. Her eyes, the flared nostrils, the hate. My three-year-old eyes ache from the machinery used to test them. My forehead is sore. I have been poked and prodded in the eyes and stared into... into the eyes and stared into all morning. I huddle into the tall metal and leather chair, frightened and miserable and wanting my mother. On the other side of the eye clinic's examining room, a group of young white men in the white coats discuss my peculiar eyes. Only one voice remains in my memory. From the looks of her, she's probably simple too. They all laugh. One of them comes over to me, enunciating slowly and carefully, "Okay, girlie, go wait outside now." He pats me on the cheek. I am grateful for the absence of harshness. The story hour librarian reading Little Black Sambo, her white fingers hold up the little book about a shoe button-faced little boy with big red lips and many pigtails and a hat full of butter. I remember the pictures hurting me and my thinking again, there must be something wrong with me because everybody else is laughing. Besides the library downtown, it's given us a little book of a special prize, the library lady tells us all. So what's wrong with you anyway? Don't be so sensitive.
Right on.
Okay. Sixth grade in a new Catholic school, and I am the first black student. The white girls laugh at my braided hair. The nun sends a note home to my mother saying, "Pigtails are not appropriate attire for school, and then I should learn to comb my hair in a more becoming style." That is like the white girl's hair. Lexi and Goldman and I on Lexington Avenue, our oldest adolescent faces flushed from springtime and our dash out of high school. We stop at a luncheonette, ask for water. The woman behind the counter smiles at Lexi, gives us water. Lexi's is in a glass, mine in a paper cup. After we joke about mine being portable too loudly. My first interview for a part-time job after school, an optical company on Nassau Street has called my school and asked for one of its students. The man behind the counter reads my application, then looks up at me, surprised by my black face. His eyes remind me of the woman on the train when I was 5, and something else is added as he looks up and down, pausing at my breasts. My light-skinned mother kept me alive within an environment where my life was not a high priority. My light-skinned mother kept me alive within an environment where my life was not a high priority. She used whatever methods she had at hand, few as they were. She never talked about color. My mother was a very brave woman born in the West Indies, unprepared for America, and she disarmed me with her silences. Somewhere I knew it was a lie that nobody else noticed color, me darker than my two sisters. My father, darkest of all, I was always jealous of my sisters because my mother thought they were such good girls, whereas I was bad, always in trouble. Full of the devil, she used to say. They were neat, I was untidy. They were quiet, I was noisy. They were well-behaved, I was rowdy. They took piano lessons and won prizes in deportment. I stole money from my father's pockets and broke my ankle sledding downhill. They were good-looking, I was dark. They were good-looking, I was dark. Bad, mischievous, a born troublemaker if ever there was one. Did bad mean black? The endless scrubbing with lemon juice in the cracks and crevices of my ripening, darkening body. And oh, the sins of my dark elbows and knees, my gums and nipples, the folds of my neck and the caves of my armpits. The hands that grab at me from behind the stairwell are black hands, boys' hands, punching, rubbing, pinching. Pulling at my dress, I hurl the garbage bag I'm carrying into the ash can and jerk away, fleeing back upstairs. Hoots follow me. That's right, you better run, you ugly yellow bitch. Just wait. Obviously, color was relative. My mother taught me to survive from a very early age by her own example. Her silence has also taught me isolation, fury, mistrust, self-rejection, and sadness. My survival lay in learning how to use the weapon she gave me, also to fight against those things within myself, unnamed. And survival is the greatest gift of love. Sometimes for black mothers, it is the only gift possible, and tenderness gets lost. My mother bore me into life as if etching an angry message into marble, yet I survived the hatred around me because my mother made me know by oblique reference that no matter what went on at home, outside shouldn't ought to be the way it was. But since it was that way outside, I moved in a fen of unexplained anger that encircled me and spilled out against whomever was closest that shared those hated cells. Of course, I did not realize it at the time. That anger lay like a pool of acid deep inside me, and whenever I felt deeply, I felt it attaching itself in the strangest places. Upon those as powerless as I, my first friend asking, "What do you do going around hitting all the time? Is that the only way you know how to be friends?" What other creature in the world besides the black woman has had to build a knowledge of so much hatred into her survival and keep going? It is shortly after the Civil War. In a greenstone hospital on 110th Street in New York City, a woman is screaming. She is black and healthy and has been brought here from the South. I do not know her name. Her baby is ready to be born, but her legs have been tied together out of curiosity, masquerading as white man science. Her body births itself to death against her bone. Black woman has been brought here from the South. I do not know her name. Her baby is ready to be born, but her legs have been tied together out of curiosity, masquerading as white man science. Her baby births itself to death against her bone. Where are you, 7-year-old Elizabeth Eckford of Little Rock, Arkansas? It is a bright Monday morning and you are on your way to your first day of school, draped in spittle, white hatred running down your pink sweater, and a white woman's twisted mouth working savage, inhuman, wide over your jaunty braids, held high by their pink ribbons. Nambulo has walked 5 days from the bleak place where the lorry deposited her. She stands in the Cape Town, South African rain, her bare feet in the bulldozer tracks where her house once was. She picks up a piece of soaked cardboard that was once covered her table and holds it over the head of her baby strapped to her back. Soon she will be arrested and taken back to the reserve where she does not even speak the language. She will never get permission to live near her husband. The bicentennial in Washington, D.C., two ample black women stand guard over household belonging piled haphazardly onto a sidewalk in front of a house, furniture, toys, bundles of clothes. One woman absently rocks a toy horse in the toe of her shoe back and forth across the street. On the side of the building opposite is a sign painted in the high story black letters, "Hates you, hates you." Addie Mae Collins, Carol Robertson, Cynthia Wesley, Denise McNair, four little black girls, none more than 10 years of age, singing their last autumn song in a Sunday church school in Birmingham, Alabama. After the explosion clears, it is not possible to tell which patent leather Sunday shoe belongs to which found leg. Where the human being absorbs so much virulent hostility and sterile functions. Black women have a history of the use and sharing of power from the Amazon legions of Dahomey through the Ashanti warrior queen Ya Asantewa and a freedom fighter Harriet Tubman to the economically powerful market women guilds of present West Africa. We have a tradition of closeness and mutual care and support from all the women courts, from the all-women courts of the Queen Mothers of Benin to the present-day Sisterhood of the Good Death, a community of old women in Brazil who escaped as slaves, who as escaped slaves provide escape and refuge for other enslaved women who are now care for each other. We are black women born into a society of entrenched loathing and contempt for whatever is black and female. We are strong and enduring. We are also deeply scarred. As African women together, we once made the earth fertile with our fingers.
Hi, and we're just doing our own show, trying to get some good music out to you guys. And right now, we're going to play some funk, actually, from New York. This group's name is Spearhead. And just listen up. Some good stuff for you. Here we go. Station is run by the people, so all you out there that actually want a radio station or something like that, come and give us a phone number.
Give us a little message or send us something on a P.O. Box 7652, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Yeah, send tapes, CDs, whatever, you know. And we've got something here coming for you. So listen and think about what's coming at you. Here's Bob Dylan on 89.3.
Gonna change my way of thinking, make myself a different set of rules. I put my good foot forward, stop being influenced by fools. So much depression, can't keep track of it no more. Can't keep track of it no more. Sons becoming husbands, stealing mothers. Old men turning young daughters into whores. Stripes on your shoulder, studs on your back and on your hand. Studs on your shoulders, straps on your back and on your hand. Swords piercing your side, blood and water flowing through the land. Well, don't know which one is worse, doing you. Don't know which is worse, doing your own thing or being cool. You can misread a man. You can take a hole in his heart with your eyes.
That was little Bob Dylan for you all, just to mellow you out and let you hear what's really going on out there. Well, next is going to be some Tracy Chapman, and hope you all dig it.
I could be someone. That was little Tracy Chapman saying she wants to be someone. Here we go, Country Joe McDonald.
Give me an F! Give me a U! Give me a C! Give me a K! What's that spell? What's that spell? What's that spell? What's that spell? What's that spell?
Here we go, Country Joe, bring it home.
Big strong man, Uncle Sam, need your help again. Got himself in a terrible jam, way down yonder in Vietnam. Put down your books and pick up a gun, we're gonna have a whole lot of fun. And it's 1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn, the next stop is Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7, open up the pearly gates. Well, there ain't no time to wonder why we're all gonna die. Now come on, Wall Street, don't be slow. Why, man, this is war of go-go. There's plenty of good money to be made, supplying the army with the tools of the trade. Just open pray to drop the bomb, drop it on a Viet Cong. And it's 1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for? Get down, the next stop is Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7, open up the pearly gates. Well, ain't no time to wonder why we're all gonna die. Now come on, generals, let's be fast. Your big chance is here at last. Now you can go out and get those reds, cause the only good commie is one that's dead. And you know that peace can only be won when a grown wild kingdom comes. Sing it! 1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for? Well, I don't give a damn. Louder! Vietnam!
Listen, people, I don't know how you expect to ever stop the war if you can't sing any better than that. There's about 300,000 of you fuckers out there. I want you to start singing. Come on.
And it's 1, 2, 3. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. The next stop is Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7. Open up the pearly gates. Well, I ain't no time to wonder why we're all gonna die. Now come on, mothers, throughout the land, back your boys off to Vietnam. Come on, fathers, don't hesitate to send your sons off before it's too late. Be the first one on your block to have your boy come home in a box.
All right!
1, 2, 3. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. The next stop is Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7. Open up the pearly gates. Well, ain't no time to wonder why we all gonna die.
All right.
Ladies and gentlemen, Country Joe McDonald. Volume 3.
As Country Joe McDonald coming at you.
Resistance revolution in America. Good evening. I hope it stops raining. One thing about the draft resistance that's different from other movements and revolutions in this country is that we have no enemies. And it's one of the beautiful things about it. And to show that our hearts are in the right place, we'd sing a song for the governor of California, Ronald Reagan. Zap.
Biden man, and he's ahead on the Ku Klux Klan. When summer comes rolling around, we'll be lucky to get out of town.
He's been like a father to me. He's like the only DJ you can hear after three. And I'm an all-night singer in a country band. If he don't like me, he don't understand.
He's a drugstore truck driving man. He's ahead of the Ku Klux Klan. When summer comes rolling around, we'll be lucky to get out of town.
Got him a house on the hill, and he can
play country records till you've had your fill. And he's a lawman's friend, he's an all-night DJ. Sure don't think much like the records he plays.
He's a drugstore truck-driving man. He's a head of the Ku Klux Klan. When summer comes rolling around Whoville Town,
since I know. Last night on a big tee, and he's got him on the war. Weighs 500 pounds and it's,
he's a drugstore truck driving man. He's the head of the Ku Klux Klan. When summer comes rolling around, we'll be lucky to get out of town. We'll be lucky to get out of town.
Speaking of getting out of town, I don't know about you, but I'm kind of thinking about doing that myself these days. Our weather is terrible, and it's May. I'm graduating in June, and damn right, it better not be this way when I'm out of there, because I'm going to be partying, enjoying myself, and finally not having to be part of that bad school system. So here we are, coming with Bob Dylan, Tangled Up in Blue.
The sun was shining, I was laying in bed, wondering if she'd changed it all, if her hair was still red. Her folks, they said our lives together sure was gonna be rough. They never did like mama's homemade dress, papa's banquet wasn't big enough. And I was standing on the side of the road, rain falling on my shoes, heading out for the East Coast. Lord knows I paid some dues getting through. Tangled up in blue. She was married when we first met, soon to be divorced. I helped her out of a jam, I guess, but I used a little too much force. We drove that car as far as we could, abandoned it out west. Split up on the docks at night, but the greenest was best. She turned around to look at me as I was walking away. I heard her say over my shoulder, we'll meet again someday on the avenue. Tangled up in blue. Job in the great north woods, working as a cook for a spell, but I never did like it all that much, and one day the axe just fell. So I drifted down to New Orleans, where I lucky was a bee employed, working for a while on a fishing boat right outside of Delacroix. But all the while I was alone, the past was close behind. I seen a lot of women, but she never escaped my mind. And I just grew tangled up in blue. She was working in a topless place. I just kept looking at the side of her face in the spotlight so clear. Later on when the crowd thinned out, I was just about to do the same. She was standing there in the back of my chain. I murdered something underneath my breath. She stuck, I must admit, felt a lot of the laces of my shoe. Trying to love in blue. On the stove, and I thought you'd never say hello, she said. And she opened it, handed it to me, Italian poet from the 13th century. One of them words rang true.
Folks, it looks like Tangled Up in Blues tangled up in the needle of the old plastic phonograph. So now as me, Nate, and Christian head out of here, we'd like to say thanks for listening and always tune in to 89.3 Free Radio Santa Cruz. So for me, Nate and Christian.
To 89.
Good night.
3. Afternoon. Free Radio Santa Cruz. And this is Remember the Flames with Morgan Firestar. This is a women's music program. I'm dispensing with my theme song because it doesn't go with this show. This show is going to be about duets between women and men and cuts from groups that are mixed that have both women and men in them. And this is dedicated to my son, Shem Tzipor. I just found out that he was killed tonight. He was actually killed probably 2 days ago. He may have friends. He does have friends in Santa Cruz. So if you're listening to this program and you're a friend of his, I hope this isn't the first you're hearing about it. I'm really sorry. Of course, I'm sorry for myself too. He was a wonderful child. And he was born in 1970, and he died before his 25th birthday in 1995. And I'd like to dedicate this show to him because he was one of the most mellow, sweet, pro-feminist males that I've ever met. And, you know, everyone adored him. And if all men were like him, we would not have much of an oppression, female oppression problem, and women would not have trouble finding men to be in healthy relationships with. And I'm really sorry that he's gone, and I just hope that all the people that he loved and touched all over the world, including people here in Santa Cruz, are better people because of him. I know I am, as his mother. I'd like to start out with one of my favorites, Bonnie Tyler, doing Total Eclipse of the Heart. And I'm not sure who does it with her. He's not credited.
Listening to the sound of my tears.